There's a thousand pretty women waiting out there. They're all living the devil may care. Well, I'm just a devil with a lot of despair. So viva Las Vegas.
Thank you, Wayne Newton. You are listening to Cats with the Dish. I am John Katzlamitas. I write the Cats Report on Las Vegas Sun, LasVegasSun.com, LasVegasWeekly.com. The show is brought to you by the Las Vegas Sun, and I say hello to the Dish.
Hi, Catsy.
How you doing, honey?
I'm good. I'm back from another crazy Montana weekend, but
this is gonna stop at some point.
No, right? I'm done. I'm done now for a while. I'm done. But I you
8 weeks almost you've spent in Montana.
Yeah, and this was a lot of kayaking, a lot of tubing, a lot of eating, a lot of drinking. So now I'm back.
Kayaking, tubing, eating, drinking.
Yeah.
The Montana quadrathlon, we'll call it.
Yes, and
ziplining.
Yeah, zip-like partying, everything. So, but enough with it. Gosh, we've been on and on about Montana. And yeah. Lily came.
Oh, yeah? How's Lily doing?
Lily's good. She'll be around at a future. We got to sporadically bring her in studio.
2 pounds of happiness.
She is. She's crazy.
Or a pound and a half, right?
But I want to get into, before we talk about what we have coming up for this weekend and for the show, I want to get into, because you have been all over the place being kind of like the MDA telethon guy.
Yes.
So now, I know Jerry Lewis was going to tape a segment. He wasn't going to tape a segment. He didn't end up taping a segment. They did a tribute segment. Like, what is the dealio on the MDA telethon list?
Well, that kind of sums it all up. I could have saved a lot of time and typing by just writing what you said there. This has been out of our Cats with a Dish little empire that we have. Yeah, this whole thing with the MDA. It's been one of the strangest stories I've ever been around. No kidding. What happened is that Jerry Lewis at the end of the process was never allowed to appear on the telethon that he hosted for for 45 years nationally to say goodbye, to say a final farewell. And he's been synonymous with that telethon forever.
And he'll never walk alone.
He'll never walk
alone.
That's
what he closes every year with.
Except this year.
It's a big tear jerker moment that everybody watches and waits for, that Jerry Lewis, you'll never walk alone.
Yeah. And it is something to see that in person. I've seen the telethon in person the last couple of years. I was embedded practically last year. And to watch him sing that song in front of an audience, it's very powerful. It really is. I'm not sure how that exactly plays on TV, because I haven't seen him sing it on TV in forever. But when you're watching that, it's really incredible. And but what happened here with Jerry and the MDA was just a simple disagreement of how to operate the telethon. They drew it down from 21 and a half hours to 6 hours without really involving Jerry in the decision. They announced that he was going to be on first to sing that song. Then they announced he wouldn't be on to sing anything. And there was a movement late to try and get him to do a recorded piece with an orchestra to sing You'll Never Walk Alone. And then that came unraveled. So as it ended up, Jerry Lewis has appeared on his last MDA telethon. It was really kind of a sad outcome to me.
Yeah, you know,
that way.
Yeah, I think the whole thing is sad because, I mean, I know even the charity, they're known as Jerry's Kids.
Yeah, they're still advertising as Jerry's Kids, by the way.
And, I mean, the recognition that he brought to that telethon, I believe, is and to the cause, to the charity, is and the disease is really unparalleled to be that synonymous.
Yeah,
I mean, the next closest thing I could think of maybe would be Danny Thomas with St. Jude's, but it's like, it's not even that, you know, that's not even as much of a direct correlation to a cause, to a charity, to a celebrity.
For this duration of time, you're absolutely right. I mean, with him hosting the telethon, they raised almost or more than, depending on what set of figures you buy into, more than $2 billion.
Wow.
And so that's a very powerful thing when you consider how much money was raised. And they've built a veritable fortress for MDA in Tucson, Arizona. Lots of people are employed down there because of this cause, as a result of the money that Jerry Lewis has been raised, including some of the people who made the decision to
I'm so, like, obviously I would hate for anything. I continue to hope that the charity continues.
Yeah,
the
muscular
dystrophy continues to bring in the much needed funds and dollars. But I do feel like I'm just going to call them the telethon people. I think that they did wrong by Jerry. I really do.
A lot
I think
of people
that, you know,
agree
I'm
with you.
I'm very much on Team Jerry here.
Yeah, and I think that there should have been a way to get him involved in the show live and for him to say goodbye and have him do it in a dignified way.
Exactly.
That never happened. And I do not know what exactly why, but I'm going to find out exactly why that was.
Yeah, you're keeping pursuing this. You're not giving up.
I'm very personally interested in this one. I really am. And we'll see what happens.
So we will stay tuned.
Yeah, and we'll see if it comes back to Las Vegas, too.
And the Cats report. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's something else you've been looking into.
I've been looking into that, too. But let us talk about something that's going on that will be happening in the future that involves someone near and dear to both of us.
Yes, we actually are pre-taping this a little bit early because we are taking off to go to Utah, St. George, Utah, to be more precise. And there is a Wayne Newton documentary that is premiering at Doc Utah, the Documentary Film Festival in Utah, and it is, I have to say, I finally got to watch the final screening for the first time today, and it's so powerful, and I obviously am related to Wayne Newton, and so I know so much about him. This is, and I've, you know, and I helped with the biography and A&E, True Hollywood Story, you know, all of those sort of things.
Right.
So there isn't really much about Wayne Newton biography that I can't
disclose.
Yeah, that I mean, these interviews that they had, they're not the typical interviews. They're not the okay, let's talk about how he was a kid and came to Vegas type of thing. It is, it really gets into his Native American heritage. It gets into, his love of the things on the ranch. And it's a different take on anything that you've ever seen about Wayne Newton. I was really moved. And there are recordings that they found of Wayne and his brother Jerry when they were the Rascals of Rhythm as little kids.
Oh my goodness.
I'm talking about when they were like maybe 6-7 years old recordings that are pretty amazing in this. So it's gonna be an interesting thing. And I hope everyone will come out and see it. It already will have happened. So, but they'll be able to see it when the ranch tour opens.
Yeah, this will be played at the ranch tour. And
yes.
Where are we on that?
End of the year, beginning of next year. So it's all good. Yeah,
so people who visit will be able to watch this.
Clip.
That's where you'll see
and,
it.
And maybe even more of an extended version and some added things because it had to go to a specific time for it. So, but it's an incredible documentary. I was, I got teary eyed a few times watching it. I have to be honest with you. And just listening to Lil Wayne sing was like crazy. Hearing these like lost recordings that I don't know how these people found. I mean, and the people that get interviewed are not the typical people that get interviewed when you talk about Wayne Newton.
Well,
so it's definitely exciting. And he's also doing a concert at I'm going to say it wrong. Tuacan,
okay.
Which is the big outdoor theater, which is absolutely beautiful. That like Little Mermaid has been at, and
cool.
Tarzan's. It's been getting a lot of great shows.
Right, I know people have visited the theater recently for those shows. All right, we got to get to it. Our guests this week are someone in my life quite a bit who works for our company, who's the host of the Vegas Deluxe website, writes Lux Blog, and is, of course, the former host of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, Robin Leach.
And my favorite, one of my favorite people in the whole world, one of my favorite entertainers, one of the nicest guys, and I'm happy to say a friend, and probably one of the funniest men I've ever met in my life, Neil McCoy, an amazing singer, and he's going to be this weekend at Prim.
Very cool
at
guy.
At Buffalo Bills, yeah.
You were absolutely right about everything you said about him. And also Josh Bell with films, so stick with us.
Hi, this is Clint Holmes, and you are listening to Cats with the Dish, or vice versa.
Welcome back. Kicking off our show this week is one of the pioneers of celebrity journalism. After getting his start by working for newspapers in England, beginning at age 17 at the Harrow Observer, he rose to prominence in the United States and was the host of the Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which focused on internationally famous celebrities in their ritzy homes. His other television work includes reporting for People Tonight, CNN, and Entertainment Tonight, and he also helped start the Food Network. He has worked in Las Vegas for a decade now, lording over the website VegasDeluxe.com, home of his Lux blog column, which also runs on LasVegasSun.com and LasVegasWeekly.com. Welcome to our little program, the eminent Robin Leach.
Boy, it sounds like I'm very old, doesn't it?
That was a really big intro, Cats. I was like, wow.
I'm winded after that intro. We need to disclaim. The Vegas Deluxe website is under the Greenspun Media Group umbrella, which is what owns the Las Vegas Sun, Las Vegas Weekly, and owns me, too.
You almost were 51 years in journalism by the time you finished that intro.
It's true.
None of us are getting any younger. So how are you doing, Robin? Thanks for coming
down.
I'm
really good. Thank you.
You look great.
I feel good. It's... You know, I've always said that if you enjoy what you do to make a living, then it's not work.
Yeah.
And I've been blessed for 50 years not working.
Yeah.
And how did you start not working? What made you want to go into
this line of non-job?
It's actually, John said 17. It was 15 going on 16.
Wow.
I hadn't quite reached my 16th birthday. And I'd passed... because I was an August Virgo baby, I'd passed my entrance examinations to university, the London School of Economics, but I broke my mother's heart and decided to go out to work first rather than ever finishing college, as you'd call it here. Only because I thought that you learned a lot more from the school of the streets than you did of the school of classrooms and desks and teachers.
Did you ever second guess that decision, Robin?
Did I ever second guess it?
Yeah,
no.
At any point in your career?
But I think, you know, I wouldn't tell anybody to do what I did. I just think that if you are so committed to what it was that you want to do, then the faster you start it, the better off you are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at 10 years of age, I the only thing I wanted to do was work for a newspaper. That was my soul. I didn't care what it was. I wanted to work for a newspaper. I loved the magic every morning of running downstairs. And the paper... print was on the paper that came through the letterbox, and you caught up with the news of the world. To me it was magic. Somebody in Israel could be telephoning an office in London, and their story would be in the newspaper the next morning in thousands of homes across Great Britain. That was what I wanted to do. So at 10 years of age, I'd made up my mind, and at 11, when I changed over to Harrow County Grammar School, I started sending a note every week to the editor of the local paper saying, when I finish school, can I come and work for you? But in the meantime, here's a story about what went on this week in our school.
Wow.
So you were the school bureau chief.
You're the gossip guy at the school.
Here's the thing, which is really amazing to me. I never heard from him once in the 5 years that I went through Harrow County Grammar School. But every week in the paper, there was the column with my initials on it at the bottom.
So you were being published
at that
point.
I was being published, but without any recognition from the editor with thank you. So when I finished school, when I was 15.
Child labor.
When I was 15, I walked over there in my short pants, and I asked to see the editor. And he came down to meet me in the front reception hall, and he said, "We've been expecting you. Congratulations. Your desk is waiting for you upstairs on Monday."
Wow.
Just like that.
Were you ever compensated at all during this period?
No, no compensation, no recognition. And when you talk about compensation, I got to tell you, my first paycheck from the Harrow Observer was £3.15 a week, which even in converting it today's worth is about $6 a week.
Wow.
And in England, you couldn't just go to work for a newspaper, you know, 5 or 7 days a week. They had to send you to school, to college for journalists. And so one day a week, we did the NUJ journalism course, which is where I learned shorthand and typing and all those things that are really important. And so when we go back to, did I miss out by going to college? No, I didn't, because I wound up going to college one day a week. And so essential law for journalists was the one course that you had to absolutely pass. Shorthand, they would give you a break on, but I was 180 words a minute at one point in my life.
Wow.
That's flying.
And Pittman's. I still use it for notes to this day. I don't think you ever give it up. And I could not believe that I was working in short pants and on a bicycle in my first job at just before my 16th birthday.
You had told me a story one time, Robin, about your first assignment.
Did it involve
a dart against a board or something?
No,
like that
was the editor. The editor, this wonderful man called Harold Empson, who had hired me without ever telling me he was going to hire me. Because I was the youngest kid on the staff, every week they'd all gather on a Monday at high noon, and they would extract their pound of flesh out of me, which was, you know, to really show me up. And he would take a dart and he would throw it into a map of the town. And Harrow was quite a big town. And the first day he did this, I was petrified, because they told me that wherever the dart landed, I had to go to that street and come back by 5 o'clock with a story that would be the page 3 photo feature lead for that Thursday's paper.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. 15, mm-hmm. 16 years of age. Mm-hmm. And so he threw it into a street in a town called Stanmore, Middlesex. And as I bicycled over to the street, wondering what I was going to do and find out, great to do cold calls, by the way, it started to rain. And it rained as if Noah was building the ark all over again. And I said, what do I do? And so I pedaled along, and I was looking like a drowned rat. And I said, you know, there's an apartment building, block of flats, at the start of the street. I go there, and I'll go up to the top apartment, because that'll be where the richest person on the street lives. So I bang on the door. I have a clue what I was going to say or anything. And a man answered the door. And you know, in those days, men never answered their doors at 1 in the afternoon, because the man of the house was at work. Mm-hmm. So it had to be a woman, mm-hmm. that answered the door.
Right.
So I sort of a little struck that it was a guy, and I said, hi, I'm Robin Leach from the Harrow Observer, and if you don't mind, can I just ask why you're home in the middle of the day? And he said,
nice icebreaker.
He said, yeah, well, I was 15. He said, well, I work from home. And I said, oh, that's interesting. What do you do? And he said, I write music. And I said, are you writing music now? And he said, yes, I am. So I said, well, I have this photo feature to write this afternoon, then send a photographer back tomorrow. And can I write about you? And you're the first person I'm going to ever write about. And it was Leslie Bricusse, who was in the middle of writing Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, for Anthony Newley.
Wow.
So this is the random.
That was a random cold call.
Wow.
Wow.
Now, I wasn't frightened about cold calls, because the final test for your journalism proficiency course, after you'd been 3 years as an indentured slave to the organization, was that you went away for a weekend and you had to compete in a contest to bang on the doors of the particular village that was nearest to where the graduation was taking place. And you had to come back with a story. And that was the first time I'd ever done cold calling. That was when I graduated, and I mean, I don't know what it is about journalism. You know, you're in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. It is if you really are a journalist, there's a fifth sense about where you should be and why you should be there. I can't explain that. Maybe you sense that when you do what you do.
I think it's the type of questions you ask too.
It's amazing,
because in this instance, the wrong question could have led you astray. You could have
back downstairs in the rain.
You would have had
I was thinking
missed opportunity.
That like it was raining, so you ran your bike into something, and then it became an accident. Story.
No, I had to come with the feature. But you know, when I graduated,
you make news later, right?
When I graduated in that tiny town and got sent off to do that cold call, I wound up on the doorstep of a very, very elderly lady, and she took pity on me, and I took pity on her, and it turned out that it was Sir Winston Churchill's private secretary.
Wow.
And she sat down with me, and I never left. I never left, because she told me stuff that I'd never heard about or read about. And Winston Churchill was always my hero, and still is to this day. And I went back, and I wrote all of this up, and I passed my graduation, and I said to myself, you know, I wonder if there's any money to be made in this. And I got on the phone to Fleet Street.
Wow.
And I said, I have this interview with this woman. What's it worth? And I think they said £25. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Wow, a fortune.
And I gave them the biggest exclusive of the year for £25. But I soon learned thereafter you could make a lot of money freelancing.
Right. You're listening to Cats with the Dish. Our guest is Robin Leach, celebrating 50 years in celebrity journalism and 70 on the planet, too, not long ago.
That's right.
Yeah. Your natal date was August 29th.
Yeah. Right? Same day as Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Did you say natal date?
Natal date.
Wow, I've never heard you be that.
It's kind of an archaic turn.
It is. So now I want to jump in. So what made the transition to come to the States? I mean, obviously you've built this incredible career in England.
I worked for the Daily Mail, which was in those days a really fine, prestigious newspaper, and I loved that. But we had a junior pay scale and a senior pay scale. And until you were 28, you could never cross over to the big league money of... of the seniors. So here I was at 21, basically stuck for 7 years, being unable to improve my lot anywhere. And I literally went to my news editor, who's a wonderful man called Ken Donlan, and said, could I get a year or 2 year leave of absence and come back? I'd love to go to either Australia or America. And he said, yep, go for 2 years and come back and your job will be here. And wherever you go, you can write for us from there. And I flipped a coin, heads for America and tails for Australia.
Wow.
So you know which the coin came up. And of course, I never went home, having landed in America in November 63, 4 days after the death of your president, John Kennedy. I sailed up the Hudson River in New York on the Queen Mary, and I Murray the K... radio commercial for Schaefer beer was playing.
And, expensive stuff.
never forget that moment.
Murray the K was king of New York radio at that
yes.
time, wasn't he?
Wins 10-10 radio.
And Schaefer beer wasn't exactly champagne wishes and caviar dreams.
It's not Schaefer wishes.
That came later. That came later. But I suddenly felt at home, and I can't explain that either. But I felt that This was the place, this was the city, this was the country where I belonged, and it wasn't where I'd lived and worked in England.
What is it about celebrities that fascinates you so much? Because you could,
their
at the
anguish.
In England, you could have gone any direction.
Their anguish, their loneliness. I think that's one of the reasons why I've been so successful in doing what I've done, is that I've taken time not to just do stories about them, not to really cultivate them as friends, because I do put a distinct line there. But, you know, I will listen to their inner grief and turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
I have a good ear and a strong shoulder. And, you know, to go into show business in the first place, you've got to be crazy.
Right.
You know from your interviews with people like Brad Garrett and Ray Romano that all comedians are inherently the most miserable people in the world.
One of those is definitely insane.
And in addition to being insane,
Megan thinks so too.
In addition to being insane, they're also very sad people, and in many cases, very lonely people. And then there is this inability to walk away from it. You know, the smell of the grease paint and the roar of the crowd. And if you go back to that very first piece of music that my friend Leslie Bricus, still a friend of mine to this day with his wife, all those years later, he wrote What's It All About? And he wrote another number for Little Chap in Stop the World, which asks the questions of an entertainer as to what the hell you're doing with your life. and
good question.
You make, if you're in show business, you make a lot of people very happy, and a lot of people, having watched you go home hand in hand, cuddled up with each other after you've gone back into the lonely dressing room, and you go home alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that somewhere in that strange characterization of people in show business, you begin to understand where the creative genius for what they do comes from, and you also begin to understand why that camera's making that noise.
It's that high-pitched, we're going to have dogs join us in a moment. Rob, let me ask you this, though, about the celebrity and covering celebrities. You have fulfilled both sides of this equation.
I
don't think you're a celebrity?
No, and I never do.
Honestly? Walk the carpet, cover the carpet.
Well, I don't often walk the carpet. I'm
Star of Night Lifestyles. Yeah. I mean, that puts you in a celebrity. I would consider you a celebrity.
Yeah, I would agree.
Outside
your
journalism.
But I don't think of myself in that term. The word that I use is I tell stories. I'm a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter to me whether it's in print or on a typewriter or on a keyboard of a computer or it's on a website or it's on television or it's on radio. I think the lovely thing to be able to do in telling stories is to only to be a link between the person that you're interviewing or writing about and the person who's going to read it or hear it. And therefore, the art of being a good storyteller is to get the heck away from being a block or an interruption
So how has it been, in your view, that you've become such a well-known figure? I mean, when I was watching Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, there weren't too many journalists who were being imitated by Dana Carvey on Saturday Night Live.
But
that's the chief example. But you became a part of pop culture through that process. That's more than just somebody who tells stories. That's somebody who's out in front, who's the host of who's the ringleader, and who seemed to be very happy in that role.
Well, I always talked about it as sending the other Robin Leach out to work. I was most comfortable when I was anonymous and talking to people and either writing it down or recording it.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that when you were, and I'd learned this from both CNN and from Entertainment Tonight, which I also helped launch, you had to find a way very quickly in television because you had 5 or 6 weeks to live. To do something, to be either outrageous, to get attention. It's like a screaming 96-point headline on the front page of the paper. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to do something. And so when I sat down and we decided what Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous was all about, the first 6 shows had to be the most outrageous, the most over-the-top segments that you'd ever seen in your life. They had to drop jaws. You had to freeze. You didn't turn away from this TV show that suddenly came. And I hoped everybody would hate it. That was my real hope. I wanted every television critic to lambast it because
you get coverage.
It would be successful and people would tune in and watch it.
Because it would draw attention to it mostly?
Yeah. And it sure enough worked. And of course, they called me the rudest man in the world because I was in Sophie Loren's bedroom asking if this was the bed where she conceived the babies with Carlo Ponti.
Mm-hmm.
they called me rude for looking in people's medicines cabinets and finding out, just why they had 95 different prescription drugs.
But who's counting, right?
Remind us never to invite Robin over to either of our houses.
I don't do it on personal visits.
Whoever that is putting up Elvis numbers.
So the shouting, when I went into these houses, I was as blown away as the audience was.
This was a natural, visceral response then, what you're saying.
Yeah, and then we pumped it up a little in the recording studio to really send it over the top. And of course, it gave the voice being so different because it was an English voice.
Yes.
And it wasn't... the somber tones.
At high volume also.
Yes.
I compare it, Robin, to in the old days when we would watch Lifestyles. This is about the same time that Monday Night Football was going on with Howard Cosell. You had to do a Cosell to hang out.
Correct.
And you had to do a Leach.
That's right.
I have to do a Robin Leach. You're looking live at Elizabeth Taylor's home. We're in a helicopter over her estate on the island of Phlegm or whatever. And we would go around the corner that
That's
way.
Really
you,
good,
you became that. And I don't know if you intended to become that, but...
I didn't intend to be imitated by celebrities, but I intended for people to walk around screaming at the top of their voice, champagne wishes and caviar drinks.
And where did that line come from?
This is a good
drunken
story.
Drunken night in my home in
Too
the
much
Caribbean
Schaefer.
With another English...
Too much Schaefer.
By then it was the real bubbly. Jeff and I, who's another English journalist... literally got hammered one night sitting, how do we bookend the show? We wanted to leave people with something that summed up the entire 60 minutes that they'd seen, and then they would mock it when they got to the water cooler the next morning. And the funny thing was that the champagne was staring right at us in our faces. And we went through this gamut of things. And once we settled on champagne, then we had caviar was the next obvious. So
in the end,
it was the simplest slogan you could ever have come up with. But to find it, to reach it, to get it, 2 English journalists had to get mad drunk.
And people still call it out to you to this day.
People still to this day, but they always get it wrong. They always say champagne dreams and caviar wishes. So I failed!
All right, Rob. With that, we have our own wishes here, and we got to cut this off now. 50-year party is going to be happening at Surrender.
Yes.
At Win Encore Friday night, and more. You're hardly finished. I know that from working with you. You're the busiest man, one of the hardest working individuals I have ever been around. That's no lie.
Thank you.
You wear me out, man. Find Robin Leach at VegasDeluxe.com. He's also on Las Vegas Sun and LasVegasWeekly.com. He's just never going to tire out. And I just really appreciate you being here, and can't wait for
Thank
the
you.
Weekend to unfold.
As I said at the beginning, I think it keeps, if you love what you do, it's not work, and it certainly keeps you going.
Right on.
Las Vegas!
As of last night, there were 5 deaths and 32 cases.
There's a cluster in an elementary school.
Okay, that's the kind of thing you're going to have to be prepared for. It's going to be all over the news big time. What's your single overriding communications objective?
We're isolating the sick and quarantining those who we believe were exposed.
Okay, good. As of this moment, you and I are attached at the cell phone.
That's Lawrence Fishburne and Kate Winslet, part of the all-star cast of Steven Soderbergh's thriller Contagion. I'm Josh Bell, film critic for Las Vegas Weekly, with a look at movies opening in theaters this week. Contagion is a fast-paced, sprawling look at what would happen if a previously unknown deadly disease swept across the world. Soderbergh juggles the various storylines with skill, although a couple of the subplots do get lost in the shuffle. Overall, Contagion is exciting, well-crafted, well-acted, and impressively grounded in real science. I give Contagion 3.5 stars out of 5. Also opening this week is the mixed martial arts drama Warrior, featuring Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton as a pair of estranged brothers competing in the same tournament. Jennifer Morrison co-stars as Edgerton's concerned wife.
Out of the house in 3 months, we'll run out of options.
Then the opponent's out of the house in 3 months. I'd rather go back to the old apartment than see you in the back of an ambulance again. I thought we agreed that we weren't going to raise our children in a family where their father gets beat up for a living.
Although Warrior has a nice, gritty, dysfunctional family tone and an outstanding performance from Nick Nolte as the brother's grizzled, alcoholic father, it loses steam over the course of its nearly 2.5-hour running time as it runs through a dual set of sports movie underdog cliches. By the time the movie gets to the final showdown between the brothers, the audience is as worn out as the characters. I give Warrior 2.5 stars out of 5. That's a look at what's opening in theaters this week. Check out my reviews in Las Vegas Weekly and online at joshbellhateseverything.com.
Welcome back. On the phone with us now is our favorite Irish-Filipino country music artist, a man who has recorded 2 platinum-selling albums titled No Doubt About It, and You Gotta Love That. He also has 2 #1 country singles to his credit, No Doubt About It and Wink. And he has also recorded a personal favorite of mine, Billy's Got His Beer Goggles On, from his 2005 album, That's Life. Saturday night, he is performing at the Star of the Desert Arena at Buffalo Bills Hotel Casino in Prim. Welcome to Cats with the Dish, Mr. Neil McCoy.
Yay!
Good evening.
Okay, I'm going to take over here for a second because Neil is one of...
You usually do take over.
She's going to take over for a good 15 minutes.
Shocker.
Neil. It was good meeting you. I'll be back later.
Okay, I'll talk to you later.
I am going to say right now that not only is Neil one of my favorite people, and by the way, he's one of my brother-in-law Wayne's closest friends. So Wayne says a holler, and he loves you, and Kat, and my mom, and Lauren, the whole family, send it out to you, Melinda, everybody over there. Shout out to Les. But I have to say that Neil is one of my favorite people in the whole world, one of the most talented performers I've ever seen. And we got to be close with him on going overseas and USO tours. And he is like Wayne's go-to man in any war, any terrible, you know, Afghanistan, first one's in, Iraq, first one's in. Wayne calls Neil the first person, and he is there to stand up for our troops constantly. So I had to throw that out there before we go anywhere else.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and I always, when I go do those things, I got to be standing by somebody, and there's no one I'd rather be standing by than Wayne Newt, so I appreciate that.
Because he's a bigger target, right?
That's right.
He's handy to have around when things get crazy.
He's got a big barrel chest.
I'm Wayne.
Like catch the bullet. Hey, Neil, speaking of that, let's talk a little bit about that. If you have a favorite memory or favorite anecdote from those trips overseas, can you share that with us?
You know, we've been on a few of them, and there have been some great moments. I think probably still to this day, the one that, and Wayne may agree with me, I don't know if he would or not.
I know which one you're going to say, yeah.
We actually got to go into Afghanistan at Christmas of 2001.
Oh, wow.
And got into a pretty hairy situation, and we were the first, I think, the first civilians into Afghanistan, because we just went in you know, our troops just went in early November 2001. Right. We got to go to Christmas, or, yeah, in 2001, and then right. we got to go into Christmas time, and it was there were some pretty close calls in there, and it was once it was over, it was really neat to think that we were part of that, but in the when you're in the middle of it, it was kind of crazy.
Is it hard to perform when you're scared?
Yeah, and usually that's just a. The only person I'm used, people I'm usually scared of are, you know, women's husbands, stuff like that. But
that, was that happening in Afghanistan?
That's not, you really get around. A bunch of women's husbands with guns, and that's even worse.
Wow, that's a whole different show then.
You know, actually, Neil, the one that I was thinking of was when we were in Iraq. Again, you guys, the first ones into Iraq, and I was lucky enough to be on this one. And they had, I'll do it real quick, they had a handshake tour. Plans the USO had set up. There was supposed to be a handshake tour, and we arrived in I think it was around Talil, wasn't it, Neil?
It was Talil, Iraq. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And there was about 6,000 troops there waiting, and it wasn't the hottest. It was about 145 degrees.
Oh my gosh, it was it was crazy. It's the hottest, obviously, I've ever been in, and we just went through a huge drought here in Texas, and if I would have been coming from where we were in Iraq, I would have come to Texas and just laid out just so I could cool off.
Yeah, it was great. And so basically they got together and Dallas Cowboy Childers were there, and they would both to Neil and Wayne, they would, Wayne Newton, for those of you who don't know, I'm sure you already figured that out, but they would practice because they would also dance along to Neil and Wayne singing live to a couple of their songs. And so it just so happened that the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders had their CDs there that they practiced to. So Neil and Wayne sang over their own CDs. My sister held up a boombox with a microphone. And and Neil and Wayne asked for a kid out in there that had a guitar. The kid came out. Neil and Wayne held the microphone for this kid to sing.
Wow.
I held the microphone so you could hear his guitar, and Wayne held the microphone so he could sing, and I didn't mean to cut you off, Dish. That was really a great moment because like Dish was saying, we just went to, it was one of those where we thought we were just going to be shaking hands and saying hello, and then we get there and they're all ready for a show, so it was kind of worked under pressure, and that kid, and I know Wayne tells this story a lot and it's a very touching moment. That kid got killed about a month after that, so it was pretty. Yeah. Yeah,
and we actually sent the video of him performing to his family.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh my God.
It was that, but it was one of those moments that Wayne says, in no matter how many shows I do, when I do it, that moment of, you know, they had fire hoses cooling these kids off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was ridiculous, and it was that moment that is something that all of us that were there, I will never forget. That was probably one of the most incredible, even though it was a miserable feeling experience in the heat and the sand flea bites and everything. It was one of the most amazing days of my life, and I think that all of us agree that we're there.
Oh my gosh, yeah, it's been some incredible trips being over there with those guys.
Who else was on that particular tour? Who else joined you guys?
It was two Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, Wayne and I, and I think that may have been it. One Dish, I don't remember.
Yeah, and there was that was that we would kind of offshoot. We had a big tour. It was, you know, Kid Rock. It was Leanne Womack, the late my dear darling friend Brittany Murphy. You know, John Stamos, Rebecca Romijn. I mean, we just had on and on and on. Nappy Roots. We had a lot of people on that. But then once you got in country, you would split off. And Wayne and Neil were going to do this. And if it would have been any other performers, they probably would have just said, "Oh, you know, we agreed to a handshake." But Neil and Wayne were there. There's no way they were not going to give those kids a show. When it was amazing.
It was a great, great moment. Oh my! And one of the greatest moments in life.
Yeah, it was
no
incredible.
Question. I can feel that. Hey, Neil, when you were a kid getting interested in entertainment and singing and songwriting, who were your inspirations?
You know, I grew up, believe it or not, I make a living in country music, but I didn't grow up listening to country music. I graduated high school in 1976, so I was in the middle of the disco scene, so I listened to a lot of disco, big band stuff, easy listening stuff, and only because I won a contest in 1981 in Dallas, Texas, and it was a country music contest. But at the time, I only really knew one country music song, and it was a song by Ronnie Millsap, and it was Almost Like a Song, and I only knew that because it sounded kind of poppy.
Right.
So I entered this contest and sang this song, and I won that particular night, and they took 12 weekly winners and got to compete, and that's I met with Charlie. But one of the great stories that I still laugh about is when I won that week, they said, "Oh, well, we had to tell you, but you'll have to sing the same song all the way through the contest." And I thought, and it was such great news because I didn't know any other country songs. So I tried to make like, oh, shoot. Well, I really want to see, you know.
I've got a whole stack of covers over here. You want me to keep singing that song?
I was clicking my heels in my mind because I thought, yes, I don't have to learn any more country music.
And what most people don't know about you, Neil, unless, of course, they see your live show, which is one, and I'm going to say it again, one of the best shows I've ever seen, that you are an incredible, you love the standards, and you're an incredible standard singer. I mean, your voice is so beautiful, but you love to sing standards.
Well, I appreciate that. I do. I loved that era. I would have made a really good Wayne Newton, because when, and believe it or not, and I know I won't keep harping on Wayne, but it's kind of crazy, because in watching him work, not just on stage, but off stage, the way that he gives his undivided attention to anybody, even if he's got 10 seconds with him, he looks at him and
exactly.
talks to them.
Yeah, it's uncanny, isn't it?
Yes, and that's what I've tried to do all my life. So when I got to do my first USO tour with him and watching him work, surely not trying to compare myself to him, but it was like, oh, my gosh, that's what I try to do. That's exactly what I try to do. So, and at the end of our very first USO tour, and the one when the Dish was on, into Bosnia and Italy and Iraq, Bosnia and Italy and Hungary, I talked to Wayne on the way back home, and I told him, I said, Wayne, it's, or Mr. Newton, I was still calling him Mr. Newton at the time. I said, it's like you wrote a book and I read it, because I do exactly all the things that you do. And it was,
you
and he was very complimentary and saying, well, that's sure nice to hear. And it was crazy, because I try and treat people the way he does. And so we had an immediate connection, and just to stay connected since then. It's a mutual admiration club when him and I are around each other.
Yeah, he just adores you, and, I mean, thinks you're absolutely amazing. And we were lucky enough to spend your birthday with you this year. Your 21st birthday, and you did a wonderful charity concert. But I you know, it's so cute to see Wayne and Neil together, because they are just so funny, and they speak this little like secret language. They're like two kids hanging out. It's great. It's so much fun.
It's like, that's exactly right. It's great. It's great to have those experiences with me.
And I mean, I'm going to say this for even the people that don't listen to country music, because I am, anybody that knows me knows that I do not like country music. I don't think I own a country music album. I have all of your songs. Matter of fact, we've been jamming them in the studio before you called
in. Yeah, we were just playing them.
That love Neil McCoy, and I love his music. And so even if you're not a country fan, you guys have to come out to Prim, because it's a show. I mean, and you are an amazing dancer. By the way, I want to start a campaign. You need to be, and Wayne says the same thing, you need to be on Dancing with the Stars.
I do. I think it would be fun. I don't know how well I would do, but it would be fun while I could stay there. And yeah, start that campaign, would you? Because after some of the people I saw they got this year, oh, my God. You know what? They should just have Dancing with me, because they're not getting many stars anymore. Oh, my gosh.
You have to do something gimmicky, Neil, like have a sex change or something to be in contention.
Yeah, just Dancing with friends is what they should put now.
Well, I'm sure you'd be great at it. We got to do this real quick. You're listening to Cats with the Dish. Our guest at the moment is Mr. Neil McCoy. Saturday night, he's at Buffalo Bills Star of the Desert Arena. Do you remember, Neil, since you're going to be in Las Vegas, in the Las Vegas area this weekend, do you remember your first trip to the city, or the first time you ever performed here, and what that was like, your impression of it?
Well, you know, my first trip and first time I performed are two different trips. I will tell you, and I don't know if it's my very first, but one of my first trips, my wife and I, who have been now married coming up in October, 31 years, we came for our 20-year anniversary and got our vows redone at the Graceland, I think it's Wedding Chapel. Elvis redid our vows, and that was... I remember he asked if she wouldn't ever step on my blue suede shoes, and I can't remember, obviously, some Elvis thing, but it was really funny. Our friends were there with us, and that was a great trip. But one of the first times I performed was, I think it was a corporate thing that we were doing on our own. We obviously didn't have enough clout to perform at one of the big casinos there, but one of the greatest memories I have of performing was, and I hate to keep reverting back to Wayne Newton, but...
Go ahead.
This is one of the greatest memories I had. After we had been on one of those Afghanistan trips, we got to, like they said a while ago, the standards, it was crazy. Wayne and I were sitting at this little bar, and I don't even remember where it was, but it was after we had been into some pretty tough places in Afghanistan, and there was no one in there. It was a few band members, us two, and about four people from another country that could have cared less, not even who I was, but who Wayne Newton was, because they didn't know him. That's how foreign they were. They didn't have any idea who Wayne was. And Wayne's piano player was there, and he got up and played this, it looked like about a 10-foot grand, and it was about 3 a.m. and we sang standards. He sat on one side of the piano and I sat on the other side, and we sang standards for about an hour and a half to just ourselves. And then when I came to Vegas, we got back from I think that was around Thanksgiving or Christmas time, and when we got back to the States, Wayne invited me to come to Vegas and just to his show. And when I get to his show, he has he's just set up the back to the same setting we had at this bar. He had brought stools out and brought the same drinks we were drinking out, and we sat there and we relived that for about 15 to 20 minutes and just did standards, and it just brought back such a great memory. And there I was performing on Wayne Newton's stage with his wonderful orchestra, and it was just a great, great time, I remember.
I was in the audience. That was an incredible show. And then you came back and built a New Year. I mean, you and Wayne built New Year's together. After that, you did New Year's Eve together. That was a great, at the Stardust.
That was at the Stardust, I was going to ask, yeah.
Because, as a matter of fact, in my office, I still have the poster of the two of you promoting that night.
And I tell you, one of the greatest things Wayne did and I had ever seen done, matter of fact, I've never had the, I don't know if I can say balls, but I never had the balls to do it.
You can.
But Wayne, it was midnight, and we were reliving that moment, and normally that's when you sing Auld Lang Syne, and that's when you celebrate the new year. But we went till about 12:18 or something, because Wayne was, we were just so into the moment, and I was trying to hint to him, kind of under breath, you know, Wayne, it's midnight. And he just kind of looked at me, and also under his breath said, oh, no, we're doing this. We'll celebrate New Year's when we get done. And I thought that was one of the best responses, because I said, okay, well, we'll just celebrate New Year's when Wayne Newton says it's New Year's, by God. So that's what we did. We finished our little bit, and then we did Auld Lang Syne about 12:20 or something. I don't even know what time.
I think Wayne's afforded his own time zone at this point. He's
that's exactly right.
Time zone
it was a lot
himself.
Of fun.
Yeah, that's great. What are we going to see in your show on Saturday night, Neil? Run us through the set list a little bit.
Well, you know, kind of like what Dish says, although I make my living in country music, you're going to hear the hits that we've had. We've been fortunate enough to have a few hits in country music, but we're allowed to do anything from Led Zeppelin to CeeLo Green.
Well,
to,
really?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Wow.
And Neil can rap. Neil can rap.
We can. You've been allowed to hear rap. You know, and the fun part about our show, we think, if you ask us, and you are...
I am. I just did.
...is that we don't have a set list. I've never worked with a set list, so...
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's great, and it's better for the band. It's fun for me. It's fun for everybody, because there is... Nobody knows what's coming next. They don't know. I don't know. I just get through the song, kind of see the reaction of the audience, and just call a song from there, and the band has to be in the on their toes the entire time, so there is no relaxing, no boredom. They don't know what's coming next, and so when people look up there and say, "Well, they look like they're having fun," it's because we are having fun. We're not just going through the motions. We're having a lot of fun.
Boy, I'll tell you, if you play "When the Levee Breaks" by Led Zeppelin, I'll rush the stage. I'll make you a deal. Anything by CeeLo Green.
We always joke about rushing the stage.
Yeah,
but
that's a long joke.
I literally do rush the stage at Neil's show. I mean, we were just at this charity event in Montana that Neil was performing at, and all of a sudden I think it was you saying the shake or something. You were starting something. It was near the beginning of the show, and I'm like, okay, I'm getting up and dancing, and I actually had a woman stop me and say, "He's performing. You're not going to get up there and dance, are you?" I'm like, "Are you listening to this song? Of course I'm getting up and dancing."
You got on stage?
No. Because sometimes at charity events, you've been to a bunch of them here.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
Kat? It gets a little stuffy. And I was
And, you know, a little too refined.
Yeah, and Neil is like, just, it's a party. It's a party when he's up there singing. It is just a party. And the minute I started to hear the shake, I'm like, I don't care if I'm the first and only person up there. I'm going. And someone stopped me to try to say, "Hey, don't go." And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" And within 2 minutes, the entire stage was packed the entire dance floor was completely packed. And no one left the dance floor the whole night because it was, I mean, everyone was just having such a great time because Neil is just such a consummate, amazing performer.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you saying that. And second of all, I thank you for starting that, because sometimes if no one is there to start that, to initiate that, then everybody just kind of sits there the rest of the night, and it's tough on the entertainers. It's tough, even though hopefully people are enjoying you. They're just they're not really showing it, and that's the toughest part. We want to know people are into our show, and sure enough, here you did come up there, and I think you I forgot who you brought with you, but it was on from their own, and it was just a great night. And that's why we like about Dish. Anywhere you're at, you know, like I said a while ago, if there's not a party already going, she's going to start it.
Oh, that's sweet.
Neil,
that's sweet.
Neil, what type of venue do you prefer to play in? Are you, if you had to pick the type of place, would it be a saloon? Would it be an arena? What to connect with your fans? What's ideal for you? Because you're playing in a place that seats up to 7,000 on Saturday.
Well, I'm sure there won't be anywhere near that amount there, but we play
after
them all.
This show, there will be.
We played all sizes, and it really doesn't matter to us because we think we have the knack of getting through to, if there were 7,000 at wherever it was, we think we would get through to that 7,000th person, not just the ones up front, but we work hard to get everybody involved, and so it really doesn't matter to us where we play. We just, we come in confident, and there is such a fine line between confident and cocky. We come in confident that we're gonna get you somewhere in that show, and by the time it's over, when you leave, we think you're going to walk out saying, that's about as much fun as I've ever had. And so that's what we shoot for, and that's the goal we shoot for every night. And I'm sure there are nights we don't get there, but if someone doesn't like us, and I know the old saying is, well, you can't make everybody like you. And my old saying is, no, you can't. But if they don't like me at the end of the night, it's not because I didn't try.
Right.
And everybody does. I mean, you take that task and you succeed every single time you're out there. It's amazing. Now, I want to talk about there's one song that you do, which of course, what I'm talking about, makes my mom cry.
Yeah.
Every single time. And she's always like, are you going to sing it? Are you going to sing it? And if you could tell me, I mean, I know originally it's called I'm Your Biggest Fan. And it originally was not something, it was a different kind of a song that turned around. If you could tell the story of behind that song.
Well, I appreciate you giving the opportunity, Dish. I found it about 12 years ago. There's a great songwriter in Nashville named Chris Wall, and he's written a ton of hits. And I was just looking for songs for an album. And I found this one, and it probably wasn't the album choice, but it was a perfect song. It basically says, and I close my shows with it, and have been for 12 years, and it basically says, thank you for supporting us, for being our fans. And I want to tell you, I'm your fan. I'm your biggest fan. And I appreciate you coming to see us every night. And thank all the Neil McCoy fans. And then as we started to do the USO tours, it took on a whole new life because there are words in it that apply to what our troops are doing, and especially in the second verse. So we started closing, doing it as our last song. We surely weren't closing that show, but we were doing it as our last song in the performances over there. And it really struck a chord with what they were doing. So it just thanks them for what they're doing. It thanks our fans for being so loyal to us for all these years. And you can really get caught up in the moment because it's after you've been out there, and whether it's at one of our shows and you've been working your butt off, or whether it's those USO tours and being overseas with those guys and girls, and understanding and them understanding what it took for you to get over there and appreciating us coming over there, it just has a magical moment in it. And hopefully people that will come see us will hang around for that last song because it really finishes off the night right. And it goes against what everybody thinks. Everybody, a lot of people think, well, you got to end the show with an up song and up-tempo song and really leave them hammering and wanting for more. But this song kind of does it in that same way, but just in a thank you kind of way. And Dish has been a witness of it. It's really a very effective song.
I get chills every time I hear it.
So even though the set list is sort of malleable and fluid for you, that song ends the show each time, huh?
It does. I haven't ended a show with anything but that in 12 years. And I don't do, I'm kind of a crazy guy because I don't do encores.
Good
I mean,
for you.
There's some, well, people have built-in encores, and I get that and understand that, but really, when we're done, we're done. We've
that's
given
good.
You,
no, that's good. I'm serious. I think that's commendable.
We've got. Yeah, well, I appreciate it. We've given you everything we've gotten. And by God, that's all you're getting. Hell with you.
Yeah, it drives me nuts, Neil. And you probably have recognized this as being somebody who's watched a lot of music. But the encore, when you know the act has four or five hits to go and they like give you the whole goodnight and they walk off stage and the lights don't go up, it's like, who's fooling whom here, you know? So I'm glad that somebody has finally said, you know what, we're going to play until we're out of music and then we all go home. You know, we all know when the end is at the same time.
Well, my father-in-law, who passed away about 10 years ago, had an old saying, a man can get too much ice water, and that's exactly right. You can give somebody too much. So uh-huh. We'd rather leave them. We want to leave them wanting more. Maybe they'll come back.
You know, it's funny that you should mention this thing about the encores, because the last show I saw at Star of the Desert was Ringo Starr and his All-Star Band. Uh-huh. And they played up until the point where they asked for the encore, and Yellow Submarine hadn't been played yet, right? And
right,
so everybody in the arena knows Yellow Submarine's coming, and they do the whole thing where they bow, and
right.
They pretend to run off stage. They all turn to their left and pretended to run, and everybody's still cheering. Then they turned around and pretended to run back and then bowed again. They never left the stage for the encore. It was the best encore, non-encore I've seen. Then they played Yellow Submarine.
I promise you, if you ever come to Neil McCoy Show and I leave the stage, I ain't coming back, bud. So you might as well just go and get out of there.
You've got a beer, you're in the bus, you're ready to go.
You're in the audience right. By then, right? You're
That's
cheering
right.
yourself.
I'm worn out. And plus, I ain't got four or five more hits. Hell, I didn't have them in the first place. So you will have heard all our hits in the show.
You have to drag out the baby grand again and improvise.
Well, I want to. You have to make me a promise, Neil, because it kind of didn't fit in with the night the last time. But I had some friends with me in your show in Montana, and we had all spent the day together. It was your birthday and in Montana, and you and I kept saying, "Will you tell the refrigerator joke? Tell the refrigerator joke." And you said, "I'm not going to wait. I'm going to say it on stage." And then the way that the night went, it never happened. And do you know? All of us, meaning my entire family, tried to explain the refrigerator joke to my friends on the car ride home from your show, and none of us got it right. So will you promise that I'm going to give a little teaser out here? It is one of the funniest jokes, but it's not really that funny unless Neil McCoy is telling it, that you have to tell the refrigerator joke on Saturday in Prim.
I promise you I will. Or the only thing funnier than me telling it is actually trying to listen to y'all tell it, because I've heard your versions of it, and it's... It is so bad that it's funny.
So, and we all start fighting with each other.
Oh, jeez.
If I can't get around telling it, I'll get y'all upstage and let y'all try to tell it. And it'll come out just as comical as me telling it.
And we all start fighting with each other. No, you've got it wrong.
That's right.
All right, Neil. Well, we're at the end of this set, my friend. There's going to be no encore. I promise you. Not today.
I'm done anyway.
But we'll have you back. All right. The next time you're in town, I promise you that we'll do this again. All right.
And we'll
absolute
see you
delight.
On
we'll
Saturday,
see you Saturday.
And everybody better come out and see Neil McCoy at Prim. And love you, Neil. Love to Melinda. And love to Mickey. Love to everybody.
Thanks, Dish. I appreciate it. Thank y'all for taking time to talk to me. I'll see you Saturday.
Thanks again, Neil.
Okay, buddy.
A fortune won and lost on every deal. All you need's a strong heart, nerves of steel. So Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas with the neon flashing and the one-armed bandits crashing. All his hopes down the drain. Viva Las Vegas turning day into nighttime, turning night into daytime. If you see it once, you'll never be the same again. I'm gonna have me some fun if it costs me my very last dime. If I wind up broke, well, I'll always remember that I had a swinging time. I'm gonna give it everything that I got. Really, look, please let the dice stay hot. Let me shoot a seven with every shot. So Viva